I'm not Sharon because she's in a meeting. So I'm Petter's wife and I'll be introducing him. Right? You already like this Bible study better. So I will remind you that when you are asking questions or commenting, you should speak up really loudly so we can hear each other and everyone who's listening to this recorded session can hear you. So Petter will be leading us in Bible study. Petter collects trains. He doesn't like olives. He roots for the Orioles. And his favorite book of the Bible is Ruth. And I invite you to ask him why sometime later. It's a great story. So without further ado, I give you
Thank you. I know, don't you want to just hear him talk some more? Or just another session tomorrow. Can you pray with me? Eternal God, amen. So we've done a couple things so far this week. For me, it's still hard to believe it's only Wednesday. And I'm trying to summarize some of the conversations we've had, partially just to help us come together as a community, but also just because not everyone goes to all these sessions. So to frame what we've been doing and why we're going in the direction that we're going, because I'm going sort of off script. It's not what I planned, but that's the fun part of this kind of community, that we can go sort of together in new places and think together about things that interest us and challenge us and provoke us and anger us. So our first day we talked about Romans and Paul and how Paul in many ways calls us to be holy, to not conform to this world, but to live through transforming love. That love is decidedly sort of for our enemies, those who persecute us and those who hate us. But we, in a lot of our conversations, we were challenged because in our own lives, we were having moments with people we have strong disagreements with. How do we show them that love? Especially love that doesn't become violent or hurtful for us in our relationships with them. So yesterday we talked about justice and how justice is one of the sort of moral points that conservatives and liberals, that most of us care about. We care about justice, even if we're not exactly sure what justice is. But that we as Christians have this rich and deep and complex justice tradition. In fact, I think one of the comments from one Pam Kencher yesterday was that, you know, the part of the problem with justice in the Bible is that which type of justice do you want? Is it fairness? Is it reciprocity? You find both in the Bible. So we're called in different ways to reflect on what justice is. And another comment about how justice is, in some ways for us, divine justice is a mystery. We're not really sure what divine justice is going to look like. So we live through constitutional justice or proximate justice or worldly justice in our relationships. So there's a real challenge there. And since we've been talking about conversations and since we are also sort of being pushed to think about how we can make active love in our conversations, how we can make our faith more active, and frankly, that's where I'm hoping to go by, certainly by Friday, but maybe even tomorrow. We'll see what happens today. That I thought one of the issues that we faced is, especially on Monday and in some ways yesterday a little bit, we've talked about when we have conversations, difficult conversations about significant issues, often we're asked to be good listeners. We're asked to understand the other. We're asked to really reflect deeply about their life and their story. But it also begs the question, how do we change people's minds? How do we talk about justice in a more fairer world, for instance, or a world that better reflects the kingdom of God? How do we talk to people about that without just listening? And I think many of us want to do that. But we live in a society where facts don't do it. I mean, we live in a society where there are different facts for the same fact. So what I want to start out with today, and eventually we're going to go to Luke, and we're going to look at a passage I think most of us are pretty familiar with, the passage, the parable of the Good Samaritan, which in some ways I think combines a lot of the things we've talked about so far, love, justice. But the parable, too, is going to hopefully provide an example of different ways to change people's minds. I think the Bible is brilliant at that. I think Jesus was brilliant at it. But with that in mind, I want you to think for a couple minutes on when you changed your mind about a significant event or issue or topic. Just think a couple minutes, and then I want you to turn to your neighbor and tell them a story about how you changed your mind. What happened? And I'd like the other person, and I'd like you to share, to think about, okay, how did that change happen? What is that person in the story telling you about how that change happened? So just a couple minutes, just quietly. Hopefully you have changed your mind on this thing. Not what to put in your cream of wheat this morning. Chocolate chips. I changed my mind about blueberry yogurt. Or peaches.
Okay, that's a change.
It's not the kind of... So once you've come up with what you're, please talk to a neighbor. Choose someone, hopefully someone you don't know. I mean, we're becoming together. We're beginning together. What? What did you hear in hearing each other's stories? Yeah.
It is understanding the conversation and learning about what you are opposed to before you can change your mind.
Okay.
You have to be educated about it.
Okay.
And a personal experience.
A personal experience.
Could you repeat those?
Sure. Personal experience, understanding, learning.
Learning about that topic, you know, before you make your judgments.
Of course, the challenge is to hear, I think. What else did you, yeah?
Compassionate reflection.
Compassion, say more about compassionate reflection.
Thinking about what you held to be a truth and finding out that perhaps it's not the same truth that you thought it was, or going back into scripture and looking to say, where am I going here with this? And then having the heart and the brains to change your mind and say, okay, I can embrace this.
So vulnerability and then openness and self-reflection to do some active work to listen. Because listen, you can listen. And my wife, no doubt, would tell you how well I listen. It takes work to be a good listener. You know, active listening in particular, yeah.
My moment of changing my mind on a topic that I thought I understood growing up in the Lutheran Church was having a young man here, Dan Spencer.
Right behind you.
Okay, careful.
Hi, Dan.
this was a profound moment in my life because I had been raised and confirmed in the Lutheran Church and been taught, as I understood it, that homosexuality was a sin, and yet then I started hearing different things at Holden. But to have Dan tell his story, and you can't argue with a person's story, and my heart turned over, and it was a completely transforming moment for me. And I thank him for his bravery.
It's cool you can have that relationship over that year. So we can, maybe one more. I want to move on a little bit.
Going along with a similar story that I heard from Steve. Also something that was striking about what Steve was saying is public humility from leaders, saying, I'm engaging in this in a new way. I don't have the answers. Let's gather together and talk about it. And that was in the 80s in LA looking at gay people in the church.
So. Stories matter. What stories do, and I think not just stories, I think good art, good poetry. Kate has been working on tremendously challenging poetry in her sessions. That these kind of help us expand our imagination about who we are and who we are. It helps us build why do stories work? Going back to the text I talked about yesterday, The Righteous Mind, Jonathan Haidt makes the argument, and I think it's worth thinking about, if nothing else. He says that many of us have this ideal that we are thinking creatures. We're rational. We're logical. In fact, there's an image I think he uses in the text where we imagine ourselves as rational creatures who are on sort of a carriage. And in front of us are our loves and our hopes and our fears and our anxieties. And we can direct and turn those horses so that they go where we want our reason to go to take it. But Haidt comes up with the metaphor that instead of being these carriage drivers, we're actually elephants. And what's an elephant? It's big. It's slow. It's plodding. P-L-O-D-D-I-N-G, not P-L-O-T-T-I-N-G. And it takes a lot to turn an elephant.
Faithful,
yeah. Well, sometimes faithful to the wrong things. It's well, you could say, or maybe for our purposes, it's faithful to your basic beliefs. And if you believe humans can't change the world, the humans don't change the climate, and your elephant is walking in that direction, how are you going to move and change the elephant? Because the rider is only going to do a little bit of prodding to change it. And we as Christians, it's interesting, I think the Christian tradition stresses the notion of conversion as a part of, I mean, that's one way to turn the elephant. You know, Paul, Luther on the road to Erfurt had a sort of conversion experience. But most of us don't have those experiences. I haven't. I don't, maybe some of you have. I think it's certainly part of the Christian tradition, but you know, most of us were raised Christian. That's just the way we were shaped. And I do think that in many ways, our basic beliefs, because they are so slow to change, because they're elephants, that the challenge then is how do you change people's minds? And in some ways, you're not going to change them overnight. And I read an article once about Sean Hannity. And the idea, what would Sean Hannity's identity look like if overnight he accepted climate change? He accepted the problems with consumptive capitalism. He accepted the problems with issues of race, gender, and sexuality. His identity would completely have shifted. His social group, his job, his vocation would be completely shifted. And you can do it, you know, Rachel Maddow, too. And so it's not just a liberal or conservative thing. It's a human thing. So much of who we are is tied up in our elephant. What Haidt then does is he says there are subtle experiences. I don't know if, I think she is here. Sly like a fox experiences.
Yeah.
Sly like a fox theory. I love that term. I think it's a great, sly like a fox experience. Haidt talks a lot about things like abroad programs, abroad trips, especially when you are immersed in a culture. But he also talks about stories, literature, poetry, art, cross-cultural experiences. Because of the way they invite you in to think about who you are and who other people are. So how do stories work? Any thoughts about how stories work?
An English teacher taught us, a professor said, it's not a story unless there's conflict in there.
Conflict. Yeah.
The story allows us to enter in without risk of being
there. Sure. Great. I think one of the key parts of a I'll summarize it for you. One of the key pieces, I think, to a good story is that it's invitational. It invites you in. And I think part of the problem with, for instance, climate science, and piggybacking on a lot of the great things that Dan is doing. In fact, I think what Dan is really doing this week is asking us to rethink our story as humans. It's not about us. It's about the biosphere. It's about the ecosystem that we're a part of. He's doing a great job of that this week. That it's invitational. It invites you in to both rethink about how things fit together and the meaning and ultimate way and shape of things. So I think good stories are invitational. Josh.
I remember being around the circle of Kata and David Lee led a term on short stories.
Oh.
And I remember wanting to have the right answer about what Dory was about. And constantly recognizing that there wasn't really a right answer. There wasn't one thing any story was about. There are a lot of people coming to an understanding based on their viewpoints, what they see in it. And that's tough for people.
Sure.
But I've learned to really appreciate that wonderful creative tension of understanding a story or attempting to understand a story without ever really being able to say, I get it.
So maybe a good story is complex and not simple. A good story is also conversational. You want to talk about it. You want to think about it. You want to reflect about it.
A good story allows us to walk in somebody else's shoes without having had their experience.
A good story is empathetic. It challenges us to imagine ourselves as someone else. It asks us to take our story and say, guess what? My world isn't just me.
Piggybacking on what Josh said, I think we all think we're going to get to some sort of conclusion, like the beginning, the middle, and the end of the story. I don't know that that's possible anymore, because everything, you know, everything is continually changing. In my life, I always expected, gee, sometime I may have all the answers. I think a lot of us do. And I don't know that that's ever going to happen. The conclusion is yet to be seen, and I guess we just go with it.
Maybe I'll summarize this point this way, that in part, a good story, I think, reflects the fact that we live in time. That we're creatures with a past, we're creatures with a present, and we're creatures with a future. And our future is until death, and even then, as Christians, we have a future beyond death. We don't know what the conclusion is. So good stories sort of overlap well with that sort of temporal sequence of past, present, and future, asking us to sort of reflect on our own ability to sort of be in time and make sense of how we act in time and understand ourselves in time. Yeah?
A good story is repeatable. And I say that in thinking back at cultures where before the written word and their whole, their history, their culture was repeated through their stories. And so with everything we're talking about, to me, a good story is something I can go and then share with a neighbor, share with somebody else.
Can I say a good story then speaks to the human condition in a variety of different contexts, and as a consequence, we can share it with others, and it's still meaningful and complex and challenging? These are great. Yeah.
And when I tell my story and what my experience has been, then the person I'm telling it to can't argue back because that's been my experience.
So a good story also is experienced or experiential. Other thoughts? I have a couple more. Yeah.
We kind of remember the emotional impact of
yes.
a story. I know there was a poem that I heard in either a high school or a single college literature course. And somewhere, I didn't remember the title and I didn't remember the author's name, but I looked for 22 years through old poetry books in used bookstores and I found the end. But I knew I was going to know the story.
22 years, that's impressive.
But it was a story and I knew I was going to know the story as soon as I saw it. And then in 1948,
Wow, that's impressive.
We couldn't hear a word of it because of the truck.
Yeah, I heard that. She's been looking for 22 years for a poem that's your numbers. And she finally found it. It stays with you. It sticks with you. Yeah.
I think it's a marvelous compliment to somebody to let them know that you want to hear their story and listen intently to their story.
I think Haidt's point is stories then speak to our elephant. The only thing I would add, and I'm doing this in part to get back at my wife, stories deal with expectation. that when we pick up a story or we hear a story, we expect something to happen. In fact, she has a novel coming out. This is how I'm getting back at her, make her blush. She has a novel coming out in February, and she spent a lot of time with her editor and the agent trying to figure out the blurbs or the summary of the book in the back. Because you want to invite the reader in by saying this is what the book's about, but you don't really want to say what the book's about. So good stories, I think, have this expectation on the part of the listener, the reader, the participant. Then you enmesh yourself or envelop yourself in the story. And then when the story's done, you're left kind of refiguring out that envelopment and those expectations. You've changed. Spoken to your elephant. And her book's coming out in February. So the title is The Rending in the Nest.
La, 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 la.
Yeah.
I just want to say we have been taking a fairly only positive approach to stories.
Oh, good.
And they can, in fact, be propagandist. They can be racist. Yeah. They can affirm our biases.
Good. Yeah.
And we have to be aware of how we tell those stories and how they're told to us. And have great. Some critical mindset for distinguishing what stories are promoting.
Good. Yeah. Got to go back to this focus of love and justice that we've been talking about.
I'm so glad you said that, because that's what I was thinking about, too. And I was thinking about this topic and about mass media and culture and stories and about where, like, my cousins, they're watching TV, right, to get their stories, maybe, right? And there's some interesting work coming out about how, like, most of the narratives in the mass media culture are, like, fall in line with sort of the conservative mindset, and how much that, you know, this all the positive things also reinforces a belief in sort of an authoritarian structure, or you should be fearful, or what, like, it's mostly white families on TV. I mean, these kinds of, it also can have a negative impact, right? So thank you, because that was what I was feeling.
Yeah, great. No, I appreciate that. That's really important to not lose that love and justice frame. So, yeah?
We have a society of people that have to have everything done for us. Case in point, I cannot stand the story that leaves you hanging as an ending. I want things completed. Everybody else has that feeling.
Of course, for many of us, a good story doesn't have an ending. It doesn't have that simple resolution. Because life, in many ways, does not have a simple resolution.
In a lot of ways, stories are life and death. Whatever stories we're living by, and the idea of whatever narrative we're living in, is a matter of life and death on some level. So they're so important, and we sort of relegate them to, that's nice, you know, sort of this superficial thing. Until you really delve into what is the story I'm living by, to really understand the narrative you're living by, changes your life.
Yeah, especially good ones that speak to that existential condition. Yeah. So maybe one more, and then I want to shift to the Bible. Bible study.
Story is also a performance. So thinking about who's telling the story, the power of the audience in that story, I think that goes to some of the things in mass media, the what does the audience want to hear, really influences the way a story is told. Mm-hmm. And to think about the context that the storyteller is coming from, mm-hmm. and how you present yourself as a white, hetero-presenting male, mm-hmm. how will that affect the way the story is told to mm-hmm. me? I think it's important to remember that stories are performances, and most of the time are contextually based and have some sort of agenda, both from the listener and from the storyteller, that goes along with the story.
Mm-hmm. So it cuts both ways, right. You know. And your point reminds me of six years ago, Minnesota on the ballot was an amendment to make marriage between only a man and a woman. And so, a number of us, a big organization, that did a brilliant job of calling against this amendment. And what they trained us to do was to call people up, and most of them were sort of moderate voters, kind of in the middle, people who were unsure exactly which way they'd vote. And they told us not to call people up and go, well, gay people are human too, gays have rights, et cetera, et cetera. They said, call people up and tell them a story. And so the woman next to me, she said, I want to tell you a story about my grandson.
About my what?
Grandson. For me, it was, I want to tell you about a story about my friend Lyle. So you tell them a story, and at the end you go, well, what do you think about the marriage amendment? It didn't pass. That's the effect of stories, both for ill and good. Now I want to shift to Luke 10. Because as Christians, we have this whole book of stories that God invites us into God's story so that we become part of God's story. And I think in many of the qualities that we've talked about with stories are exhibited by this divine gift. And so I want to think about sort of how, for instance, parables in the gospel model that kind of ability to talk to people and to subtly speak to their elephant, if nothing else, through stories. I chose Luke 10 in part because a Good Samaritan story, part because I suspect, I hope I'm not on a ledge here, that you've heard of it before. And what I'm really interested in for you to talk about is how it works as a story. I also chose Luke because, in part, Luke is a text that works well with Romans. The Good Samaritan story also combines issues of love and justice at the same time. Love, to be loving is to be just, and to be just is to be loving. Luke as a whole is usually seen by scholars as a very Gentile gospel. If anyone remember it starts in the second chapter, really, but anyone remember who the sort of main political character is at the beginning? What? He's the writer of it. Caesar Augustus makes an appearance in chapter 2. Caesar Augustus, who, according to the myths around his birth, his mother Atia was visited one night by a snake and became pregnant. The snake represents Apollo. So Caesar Augustus is this semi-divine figure, this emperor. He's someone who is the most powerful man in the world. And if you remember Luke's birth story, where is Jesus born? Bethlehem, but where? Physically. In a manger, in a stable. So chapter 2, which is the birth story, has Caesar Augustus appear in his nice powerful throne, ordering a census. And where is Jesus born? The true king. The lowliest place you can go with the animals. Not even in a human dwelling. He's the anti-Caesar. That's one of the, I think, dominant themes you get in Luke. Luke also works really with Paul because in some ways, the way we've talked about Paul is Paul really cares about the Spirit and being the fruits of the Spirit and how our bodies are changed by living spiritually through the law of love. And Luke ends, anyone remember what Luke's Jesus does on the cross? He's the only one of the Gospels that does it.
Forgive them.
What? His last words.
Into your hands I commend my spirit.
The Spirit then reappears and makes an appearance with Jesus initially in the book of Acts, which then details sort of the living of the Spirit post Jesus' death all the way to sort of Rome. So I think it's a good fit for what we've been talking about so far this week. Well, what I'd like you to do is look at the parable of the Good Samaritan. And based on what we sort of talked about with the framework of stories, how does this parable work as a story that speaks to our elephants? How does it speak to our elephants? And conceivably, how does that help us think about the types of conversations we can have with people about speaking to their elephants? Make sense, the question? Okay, so maybe 4 or 5 people together. Introduce yourself, hopefully new people. Again, the beauty of Holden is building community. So maybe we'll take 10 minutes. Okay. I'd like to bring us back together. possible. So what came up as you told the story of this story? Came up as you told the story of this story.
Not sufficient enough to know the law.
Say it.
Not sufficient enough to know the law.
Okay, so the meaning of the story, or at least one meaning, is faithfulness is more than
it's about
this.
Doing, it's not about knowing.
Okay, so that's a meaning claim. That's good. But how does it work as a story?
It pulls you in.
It pulls you in. How?
Makes you make an evaluation.
How?
Go ahead. I pay attention to the first line of any story, but this is a great one. A man was going down from Jerusalem to Jericho and fell into the hands of robbers who stripped him, beat him, and went away, leaving him half dead. You got to hear the rest of the story.
it's provocative.
Yeah, okay. Violence.
Well, I think we don't know anything about that man besides that he's where he's coming from and where he's going. And I think that opens it up to, and right before that, you know, this lawyer is asking Jesus a question. And I think, in a way, Jesus is proposing, that's you. This is not a homeless person on the side of the road. This could be a very wealthy, well-to-do person who could be you. And you are the one in need of help.
Could be any one of us. I mean, I do wish the translation wasn't man. A gender issue, which you could say push people away. But I think the heart of the story is it wants to say, is this you? It asks a question. It invites you into that kind of narrative proposition. And all of us have suffered, I imagine, at some point, and all of us can imagine suffering. I mean, is this you? Yeah.
It also gives us a variety of characters within to identify, and most likely each of us can identify with every single character in the story.
And I think the beauty of the fact that we can identify with any of the characters, it also speaks to you at different points in your life, different contexts. I know I've been a rabbi. I know I've been a Levite. I know I've been a Samaritan. I know I've been the man on the road.
Or the robber.
Yeah, great. Yeah, no,
first true. Time today, I thought I've been the robber sometimes. I've hurt people, you know.
Or the innkeeper.
Yeah.
Write that one out.
Yeah.
So throughout time, one of the most successful tools for an attorney is not to give you the answer, but to lead you from point A to point B and all the way up. And then just short of the conclusion, you shut your mouth. And you let that person come to their conclusion on their own, even though they've been led there. And that's what Jesus turned that trick on his attorney, on the lawyer, and gave him this parable and gave him this story. He did not tell him the answer. He did not answer the question. He led him to that conclusion, and then that conclusion became his own.
I like that, yeah. Josh?
I think you really get pulled in and care about the characters for whatever reason, because of maybe it's such a dramatic beginning. But one person in our group said, wanting to know more about the Samaritan and what inspired the Samaritan to do that. Does that Samaritan have a story of being beat up on the side of the road, or, you know, just, you know, getting inside
those
characters and thinking about, you know, what would inspire us or that person as a Samaritan to do something like this, and to think about the backstory as well. I love how it captures your imagination.
So you could say it tells you enough, but not too much. It's broad enough that these kind of tropes, almost tropish characters.
Yeah. If I quote on this one. I have to. If the woman who fell on his
knees. Speak louder, please.
He's losing his voice.
If the man who fell on the thieves was a good Jew, as the story seems to imply, but was avoided by the priest, avoided by the Levite, like, what would have been his horror or his response to find out he'd been cared to by a Samaritan? So I put myself in the same thing and think about, you know, a good Democrat walked by, a good progressive walked by, and then a Trump supporter helped.
So even the ending is complex, because you have a good Jew being helped by a Samaritan, a sort of bad Jew, shall we say, or bad Jew is the wrong term, but...
What would be, I mean, repulsive in a real guttural sense, you know, it would just, not an intellectual debate, just the whole part of me touched by someone who everything about you has been told, don't go near them.
And this just, didn't this just happen recently in the shooting in Alexandria?
Yes.
Where the Louisiana representative who was shot, who's extremely homophobic, one of the Secret Service agents that helped him and was shot.
Yes.
It was a lesbian. That story. Yeah.
So all of that is a reminder that stories have a cultural context, and you often can't hear the story without knowing the cultural context. So as we were saying, you know, as preachers, when we're trying to preach on this text, have to somehow get across what the word Samaritan means in the context of the story, and then you can hear the story. Without that, it simply means this, in our culture, a generic do-gooder, which is almost the exact opposite of what it means in the story.
Sure, yeah.
So cultural context is always, you know, essential to hear a story.
Well, I think it begs the question that stories are not passive experiences. They require a lot of us. They require us to listen, but they also require us to think and to do research and to educate ourselves. I mean, some of the same things that we brought up when we generally talked about stories. I think that's really important. I think that's the beautiful thing, is that a lot of what we're talking about, and I think some of us are frustrated with, because last night someone said, you know, the joke among Lutherans is that all we do is talk. So how do we become more active in our faith life? How do we become more active? And I think that activity, not only is it just out in the world, it's also how we read these texts and share these stories with each other. How do we get those stories across? Yeah?
I'm intrigued by the fact that this is a story within a story. There's the dialogue between Jesus and the lawyer, which is set up with the lawyer's question, who is my neighbor? And then at the end, Jesus twists the question, who proved to be a neighbor? And that external story shapes how you read the internal story. Almost sets us up to read it wrong and then flips it at the end and makes it hear it in a different way. And,
well, it goes back to that idea of your expectation. And obviously, culturally, too, our expectations are very different than the people 2,000 years ago who would have heard this story, in part because we don't quite know exactly the Samaritans, the Levite, the rabbis, what that would have looked like exactly. So we have to do some translation. I think that's the hard work of being active readers, active listeners. But absolutely, yeah.
And Jesus also let the... it was interesting that he said, first, what do you know? And the guy quoted, I mean, he quoted the scripture and said, you know, love your neighbor, knew that. And then said, who is my neighbor? So he actually asked that. But then at the end, after Jesus told the story, he said, so who is the neighbor? Mm-hmm. And the guy drew his own conclusion.
Mm-hmm.
We've
been censored.
I just want to point out that I think there is a distinction between the way that we were talking about stories earlier and this, which is more of a parable, right? In the sense that I don't, like, some of what people were saying earlier had to do with we like stories that are complex and that don't have a moral or a point. And I mean, this is a pretty didactic story.
Good point.
And so I think if I was having a conversation with somebody and they told me this kind of story that ended with a, like, I mean, when Jesus asked that question at the end, it's not, there's not room to be like, hey, I think that
Levite was actually the neighbor, right? I mean, there's not like open interpretation there, right? Like Jesus has a point, and I think a lot of so the question for me is, are we in a context now where hearing parables would be effective for us, or is it stories that do leave room for more ambiguity and stuff that and this also doesn't allow us like deep empathy, as people pointed out with. I mean, like, we don't really get a lot of information about what it's like to be a Samaritan, right? Except this action. So just for me, brings up the question of the difference between parables and stories, and like which are truly most effective on our hearts. I don't know.
That I'm a grief and loss counselor, therapist. So the word pity really grabs me. Jesus took pity. So in my practice, I'm sort of making this up as I go, so I don't know the Greek translation of pity, I don't know. But pity, sympathy, empathy, compassion. None of us wants to be pitied. And in therapy, to break down people's defenses to get to vulnerability, takes a lot to say, I don't. So pity in my mind is hierarchical.
Yeah.
I take pity on you. Mm-hmm. Don't pity me. It's a power thing.
Yeah.
And so for people to be okay with being vulnerable, Jesus takes pity all the time. Mm-hmm. And vulnerability is really hard to get to in ourselves. Like, when was I the person to be? Wow, what, maybe I'm the one right now beaten up. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what therapy's about. What was pitiable in your own experience? But we don't like pity. So we want to be the people who help. Mm-hmm. And so people in therapy are all saying, well, that bad. It's not that bad. Don't pity me.
Yeah.
So I think pity has a huge something in here.
Okay.
And I'm not sure what it is, because we all like to just defend against it.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Yeah. Thank you.
A couple of quick things. There's just so many layers to this story. One layer I don't know if anybody's brought up yet would be the possibility of who is Jesus in this story and who is God in this story, and that idea of it being a metaphor. We tend not to jump to the metaphor about God as much with this story theologically because we want to be connected to the characters more and have it, you know, be connected to that human interaction. But there are different times in church history where it jumped immediately to this understanding of who, what does this say about God? What does this say about who Jesus is? And is this a message about that? But the other thing that I've always been interested in is the fact that this comes right after the 70 were sent out in terms of the context. So the 70 have just been sent out. They're on their own, on the roads, traveling. Is this also a message for them because they've been the priest, they've been the Levite, they've been characters in this story too. So.
That's great. Yeah.
I think that's how important releasing things has to do with pity as well. How mine is just a brain injury, but so I don't understand a lot of stuff, and I don't even be able to make sure I'm talking about the same thing we're talking about. But what's been helpful for me is releasing a lot of the anger or the frustration or the pity that I feel I've been given. It's not fair. You need to do that sometimes. So we have to listen to some people who need time to release things.
Maybe the last two here.
Yeah, this story has always instilled me with a sense of despair because I read it and I think, oh, why would you have just walked past that man that was lying on the ground? Why didn't you help him? And yet I walk past the street people all day long and I don't know what to do with it. I myself cannot help all of them. So I don't know what to do with this story as far as what I'm called to do.
Well, I also think it indicts all of us, right here, right now. What could we be doing with our time and our active faith? And what are we doing?
Talking.
It's convicting. Yeah. Convicting.
Well, we were talking about that too, and that was a powerful question. But I wanted to think about the difference between
fictional stories, which do invite you in and do build empathy, but personal stories, I think when we tell our own story or tell someone's story, that has great power and can be persuasive. I like to tell the story of the Afghani refugee family that our church is sponsoring. And that really speaks to people, I think, in an issue, a time when we're thinking a lot about refugees. That just one.
Well, we're over time. I'm glad to talk about this more, but go and share your stories. We all have profound stories.